This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Julian Ng and Sherrod Kutten. 7:47 on the clock right now. We've got the Breakfast Grill coming up in just a few minutes with Dato' Ilyas Muhammad, the Executive Chairman of Koperasi Amanah Pelaburan Berhad, or KAPB. Now, they're in an interesting position at the moment because they're attempting to pioneer a new corporate identity for cooperatives around the country and also to encourage greater economic participation within the Bumiputra population.
So in this grill, Dato' Ilyas, who is the chairman, will outline investment strategies to maximize returns for its members. I guess that's what all cooperatives would have to do. And this is coming in a very volatile environment, as we can see.
And they've done so well. I mean, they have paid, 15% on investments in the cooperative. So the question is, why? Why are they doing so well? Yeah. What are they doing right in order to pay such handsome dividends?
And can they keep it up, right? So lots of questions for Dato' Ilyas from Koperasi Amanah Pelaburan Berhad on the Breakfast Grill today. That's coming up in about 15 to 20 minutes, so stay tuned. But first, we'll catch you up with the business news of the day. Carlsberg Malaysia posting a 33% increase in its net profit to 63 million ringgit for its first financial quarter. It says that there was a higher volume and contribution from both its Malaysia and Singapore operations.
Singapore did particularly well because sales over there jumped about 24% and profits doubled. This is due to some Chinese New Year campaign, which was very successful, but the results haven't seen the full impact of those punitive alcohol tax rises in Malaysia that only started in March.
Yeah, so we call that, we've been disputing the name.
The sin tax.
So we've offered a bad habit tax, but I want to offer another one.
Okay, what's yours?
The auntie tax.
Auntie?
Yeah, basically, you know.
As in auntie and uncle.
Yeah, as in the state operating like an auntie.
Like a nanny tax.
A nanny state tax.
I offer another one, the personal choice tax.
Well, I think it's kill yourself to prevent you from dying tax, I think. Prevent the health problems tax.
All right, so let's talk about this tax because all of these taxes, these excise duty, the changes to the structure and the higher operating costs are really posing a challenge for brewers because they now are faced with higher costs and the need to raise prices. But what will that do to demand? So Carlsberg is saying that they're mulling raising prices this year. And I recently spoke to Heineken Malaysia, who say that they are too considering this. And I also would like to point out that the anti-profiteering bill expires at the end of June. Now, that bill, I think, prohibits any rise of prices following GST. And now that it is coming up to the end of its duration, could we see more price hikes across the board?
So going by these nanny state arguments, right, I'm not sure why people are so up in arms about this kind of thing, because when you make a policy like a GST, you must allow corporations to manage their businesses according to market principles. And if they have to manage their costs, then they would have to find a way to either raise prices, or if competitive factors are so great that they have to reduce them, then so be it, right? It's part of the
market economy.
And now Carlsberg is saying that they have to raise prices by 3 to 5%. I mean, this is a direct response to a government's policy. The government, whether they know it or not, they intend for this to happen, right? And so this is going to go up by 3 to 5%.
The question is with, consumption of goods that are part of people's habits, you know, weekly, daily habits, how elastic is it, right? So you might push up prices of alcohol. Will that stop somebody who drinks alcohol habitually from actually reducing their consumption? I'm not quite sure. I think knowing the people hang out with, demand is pretty inelastic.
Okay, well, I do agree with you. In that respect, it could be inelastic, but it could also push people to contraband products. So products that have been smuggled in without paying the excise duty, which are cheaper, bootleg alcohol. It might. So we saw that with cigarettes, the higher the cigarette prices got, people shifted to contraband, illicit cigarettes. That's the same with the alcohol products as well. And I think in that sense, inelasticity may be for the product, but they might get it in the black market.
Well, you know, I don't think my friends are going to go down to Brickfields and get, you know, a bottle of seven C's, a liter of which I think retails at like 15 ringgit.
Well, right. this
mix of water, Parisa alcohol, you know, alcohol and Parisa gin, if you like.
I do like your point about some consumer habits of habit-forming substances, right? So you saw Carlsberg posting a 33% increase in net profit. But on the other hand, a different type of consumer product, for instance, Amway's first quarter net profit fell by half, almost half. So it almost halved in terms of its net profit, but it still declared a dividend.
That's right. Adding to those woes, they were impacted by weaker ringgit, and which resulted in higher importation costs. They also had lower sales as a result of the poor consumer sentiment. I guess you can change your habits as far as MLM type products are concerned, right? It's easy to change from a very high quality washing powder to some cheaper one. That doesn't really affect your satisfaction.
Or your liver.
Or your liver.
With an extract of it. Okay, all right. However, we just have some quick news that Nielsen's latest survey on consumer confidence remains quite stable in the first quarter, Jules. So what does this tell you overall? I mean, in terms of consumer consumption.
Yeah, are we burying our heads in the sand? I mean, is it one of a situation where we know bad times are coming, or that this is going to be, a tough year, but let's just spend ourselves into optimism.
Well, it does have some warnings. The survey actually said that Malaysians are worried about the economy and job security. And if you look at Malaysia's ranking, we are 36 out of 63 countries. It's not exactly at the top of consumer confidence.
Okay, 7:53 right now, and low-cost airline groups and manufacturers of smaller passenger aircraft will be among the main winners after Southeast Asia's Open Skies Agreement finally comes into effect. Now, airport capacity constraints, however, could limit some of these benefits.
So think of it this way. Open skies, open airlines. Airlines would be given the free hand to do whatever they want to do, including launching unlimited flights from their home point in ASEAN to any other international destination. This would, I guess, benefit some of the more dominant players in the market, for example, AirAsia, which has a formidable fleet size, and AirAsia themselves have expressed the goal to actually launch a lot of international flights from places like the Philippines, for example. With this open sky scenario, they will be allowed to do that.
Can you correct me if I'm wrong, but when it comes to purchasing aircraft, it's actually the lead time is a couple of years. You don't simply go out and shop for more aircraft if you need one. I mean, it takes a bit of time to do so, right? So expanding your fleet to take advantage of these open skies would have happened some time ago in order for it.
Which is why the incumbents have such an unfair advantage. They've already got that first mover advantage, and AirAsia, of course, have planes on order already, so they have already planned that into their books. I wonder whether this is why the Value Alliance was formed, yeah, to take on the bigger guys.
So yesterday we spoke about how 8 low-cost carriers are forming an alliance to take on the big boys, AirAsia, Jetstar, Lion Air. And, you know, if you look at fleet size alone, the AirAsia has more aircraft than all these 8 low-cost carriers combined. And I do think that perhaps they feel like they need strength in numbers to fight bigger competition. But when it comes to the Open Skies Agreement, Jules, this allows airlines to launch unlimited flights from their home port to any point in the region subject to airport availability. Subject to airport availability.
And that's landing rights, are we talking?
Landing rights. So,
well, it's not the landing rights. You now have the rights to land and take off, but it's the capacity constraints. How many planes can land onto your runways.
Yeah.
And this really, I think, is interestingly throws the ball into the courts of airport managers. They would have to plan very well how much to expand or not to expand and how to attract all these different airlines. And it really spills over into our discussion of whether Malaysia Airlines should have a kind of national identity if the main purpose of the airport and the policy of these open skies is to just attract tourism traffic, business traffic, right? Airline traffic.
So you've got an airport like Changi, which is expanding. It's got 3 terminals at the moment. It's already planning. It's already constructing a fourth terminal and planning a fifth terminal. But then you, on the flip side, you've got airports like the Philippines, which is the Manila airport is ranked in the top 10 worst airports in Asia. So you want to kind of level up your capacity, increase your capacity in airports under the Open Skies Agreement so that you, your country, will get the maximum benefit from it.
I mean, it's interesting to note that Jakarta's, Soekarno Hatta International Airport could expand, except for the question of land acquisition. It's having trouble. If you've been to Soekarno Hatta, you know there's a lot of land apparently surrounding it. And I think it's one of the prettiest airports in the region. It's my personal favorite because it's very human in scale.
7:57 right now, and the Ministry of Finance says that the government is currently studying ways on taxing people engaging in the digital economy. So people like Uber, for instance, because the government could face losing revenue if it ignores this growing portion of the economy. Is this a good idea, Jules?
Yeah, Tan Sri Irwan Sirigar actually says that an Uber driver could earn 7,000 ringgit a month. I guess you want to get them into the fold of taxable income and taxable revenue. The government needs more and more revenue, right? But I would say, these are the small guys. This would be considered SMEs. I'm just wondering if the imposition of tax for the digital economy would slow down the adoption of something that is so high tech and something that is growing. Perhaps the government should do something to encourage this kind of businesses.
Would you consider Uber an SME?
Not Uber, but the driver, the individual. Uber would not, be an SME. So Uber themselves should be taxed if we can find out which domicile they are in, right? They're all over the world. But then the participants, would they, what kind of policy, what is the correct policy treatment for these guys?
And I think, actually the question of their revenues, I take ride shares every day, right? And what I've noticed is over the last year, the incentive structures have changed so much that they're now drawing rather modest incomes. If you entered this field a year ago, you were making super amounts of money. Now they're just making enough, and it's quite modest now, I think.
Yeah, but I think this also highlights the redistribution policies of the governments as well. I mean, you tax them, they are low-income earners, but you at least distribute back through some kind of social program, I think.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.